The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
We have two authors, each with a fair amount of experience dealing with this thing we call reality, who will fearlessly tackle the question and at the very least present us with an idea as to how one might approach answering it. Edgar Caret was born in Tel Aviv in 1967 to a diverse family. His brother heads an Israeli group that lobbies for the legalization of marijuana, and his sister, an Orthodox Jew, is the mother of 10 children. Caret regards his family as a microcosm of Israel. An internationally acclaimed short story writer, his books include Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God, Gaza Blues, The Nimrod Flipout, Missing Kissinger, and just out in paperback, The Girl on the Fridge, a collection of 46 sometimes disturbing, usually very funny, and very short stories. He's written several feature screenplays, including Skin Deep, which was awarded the Israeli Oscar, and Wrist Cutters, featuring Tom Waits, was released in 2007. Jellyfish, his directorial debut with wife Shira Geffen, won the coveted Camera d'Or Prize for the best first feature film at the Cannes Film Festival in 2007. Mr. Caret is at present a lecturer in the film department at Tel Aviv University. Joining Edgar in grappling with this evening's big question is Ben Ehrenreich. Born and raised in Long Island, he studied religion at Brown University and eventually landed in Los Angeles, where he still lives, writing fiction and journalism. His reporting has afforded him the opportunity to experience a wide variety of realities, from Afghanistan to South America, the various and sundry realities that comprise the U.S., Haiti, and most recently in the last issue of L.A. Magazine, the grim realities of the horrific treatment of immigrants in our own backyard. His articles and essays have been published in publications such as the L.A. Weekly, The Village Voice, The New York Times. His fiction has appeared in Baum, McSweeney's Black Clock, Swink, and elsewhere. His first novel, The Suitors, which is on sale outside in the lobby, was published in 2006. Once this evening's authors have exhausted themselves with tonight's question, they will take some little questions from the audience. Please remember to wait for the microphone as we record for podcast. And also, please, we ask you that you make it a question that you ask and not a statement that you make. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in turning off our cell phones and in welcoming Ben Ehrenreich and Edgar Caret to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you, Justin. Should I seat you again?
Oh, okay.
So... So we're each going to read a short story, just so you kind of know a little more about our writing. The story I'm going to read is called Hat Trick. At the end of the show, I pull a rabbit out of the hat. I always save it for last, because kids love animals. At least when I was a kid, I loved animals. That way, the show ends on a high note, at the point when I pass the rabbit around so the kids can pet it and feed it. That's how it used to be. It's harder with kids nowadays. They don't get as excited. But still, I leave the rabbit for the end. It's the trick I love best, or rather, it used to be. I'd keep my eyes fixed on the audience as my hand reached into the hat, groping deep inside it till it felt Kazam's ears. And then, Alakazim, Alakazam, and out it comes. It never fails to surprise them. And not only them, me too. Every time my hand touches those funny ears inside the head, I feel like a magician. And even though I know how it's done, the hollow space in the table and all that, it still seems like actual magic. That Saturday afternoon in the suburbs, I left the hat trick to the end, the way I always do. The kids at the birthday party were incredibly blasé. Some held their backs to me, watching a Schwarzenegger movie on cable. The birthday boy wasn't even in the room. He was playing with his new video game. My audience had dwindled to the total of about 4 kids. It was especially hot that day. I was sweating like crazy under my magician suit. All I wanted was to get through it and go home. I skipped over 3 rope tricks and went straight to the hat. My hand disappeared deep inside it, and my eyes sank into the eyes of a chubby girl with glasses. The soft touch of Kazam's ears took me by surprise the way it always does. Ala Kazim, Ala Kazam, one more minute in the father's den, and I was out of there with a 300 shekel check in my pocket. I put Kazam by the ears, and something about him felt a little strange, lighter. My hands swung up in the air, my eyes still fixed on the audience, and then suddenly there was something wet on my wrist, and the chubby girl started to scream. In my right hand, I was holding Kazam's head, with his long ears and wide-opened rabbit eyes. Just the head, no body. The head and lots of blood. The chubby girl kept screaming. The kids sitting with their backs to me turned away from the TV and started to clap. The birthday kid with the new video game came in from the other room, and when he saw the severed head, gave a loud whistle through his fingers. I could feel my lunch rising to my throat. I threw up into my magician's hat, and the vomit disappeared. The kids were ecstatic. That night, I didn't sleep a wink. I kept checking my gear. I had no explanation at all for what had happened. Couldn't find the rest of Kazam either. In the morning, I went to the magician's shop. They were baffled too. I bought a rabbit. The guy tried to sell me a turtle. Rabbits are played, he told me. Nowadays, it's all about the turtles. Tell them it's a ninja. They're a freak. I bought a rabbit anyway. I named it Kazam too. By the time I got home, there were 5 messages on my machine. All job offers. All from kids who'd witnessed the performance. One kid actually stipulated that I leave the severed head behind, just like I'd done at the party. It was only then that I realized I hadn't taken Kazam's head with me. My next gig was on Wednesday. A 10-year-old in Savion Heights was having a birthday. I was stressed out all through the show. I couldn't get in the zone. I fucked up the Queen of Hearts trick. All I could think about was the hat. Finally, it was time. Ala Kazim, Ala Kazam, the penetrating look at the audience, the hand into the hat. I couldn't find the ears, but the body was the right weight. Smooth, but the right weight. And then the screaming again. Screaming, but also applause. It wasn't a rabbit I was holding. It was a dead baby. I can't do that trick anymore. I used to love it, but just thinking about it now makes my hands shake. I keep imagining what terrible things I might wind up pulling out of there. The things waiting inside. Last night, I dreamed I put my hand into the hat and it was caught in some creature's jaws. It baffles me how blithe I used to be about sticking my hand into that dark place, how blithe I was about shutting my eyes and sleeping. I've stopped performing altogether, but I don't really care. I've stopped earning a living, but that's fine too. Sometimes I still put on the suit when I'm at home, for kicks, or check the secret space in the table under the hat. That's about it. Apart from that, I pretty much stay away from magic tricks. I pretty much don't do anything. I just lie awake and think about the rabbit's head and the dead baby, like the clues to a riddle. It's as if someone was trying to tell me, this is no time to be a rabbit, or a baby, or a magician.
So I'm going to read a story which is, it's called Truth 3. It's a part of a series of short allegorical stories I've been working on over quite a while, and the main character of these 3 particular stories is Truth. Tired for a while of wandering, Truth craved the comforts of home. She found a down jacket, thermals, and snow boots at the Salvation Army and hopped a freight train headed north. The boxcar steel floor soon became too cold to sit upon. So Truth did her best to balance and stand as the engine hurled her rattling through the night and the crystalline cold of the mornings. The train leapt a latitude or two before it finally shifted to a siding and stuttered to a halt beside a silo in the middle of a frozen field. Truth sat and squinted out the boxcar door. She listened to the hissing and the hiccups of the brakes. Hours passed before she heard a sudden clanking. Then all went silent, save the receding hum of the engine as it chugged away without her. Truth is patient, and she waited a week, but she knew it was unlikely an engine would return before spring. And though the boxcar's walls provided ample shelter from the wind, it was not shelter she was after, so Truth swung down and trudged off across the field. She walked for days. Her boots crunched through the snow and frost. Her breath danced like a ghost before her face. She stamped through icy puddles with her heels and threw snowballs at faraway trees. At last she came across a town. She hiked its one lonely road until she found the Greyhound Depot, just a ticket counter inside the hardware store, really, with a low bench outside for waiting. Truth stamped the snow from her feet and waited on the bench. She caught a northbound bus and sat beside a skinny man with short, straight hair dyed strawberry blonde. The man ate fried chicken from a brown paper sack, but never offered Truth a piece. He didn't sleep at all, but puzzled over the same crossword for 1,000 miles, and returned from the bathroom every 30 minutes smelling of cigarettes and gin. Of course, Truth knew all the answers to his puzzle, every down and each across, but the man never asked her for help, never said a word in her direction except muttered, "Pardon me's," on his way to and from the can, so Truth did not offer any hints. The bus stopped to refuel and chain its tires and change its driver, and it stopped again in the morning at the end of the line. She got off and wandered the ice-blown streets until she found a lightly bearded woman with tired green eyes who agreed to rent her a sled and 4 dogs with which to pull it. Truth whipped those dogs northward until there were no trees at all, not even any bare trunks that had once been trees, just ice and snow and wind. The dogs bounded forward without a bark or a whimper. A storm blew down on them, with wind so cold that one dog froze dead in its tracks, and the other 3 refused to lift another paw. They huddled in a tight clump around their fallen friend, their whining inaudible beneath the screaming winds. Truth tried whipping them a while, but the sting of the lash was barely a tickle compared to the cold, so she gave up and left the dogs. Bent double by the wind, Truth trekked on, ever upward. The storm wove lace doilies of frost in her lashes. She leapt across ice floes, scaled bergs and dunes of shifting snow. Day could not be told from night. The same icy dark prevailed. So Truth did not bother to stop or rest, but trekked on homeward through the hours. At last the blizzard calmed. The winds died down. With the stars unveiled, the aurora bursting and the moon glowing full, the light was almost worthy of the name. Truth tramped onward and smiled at the sky. She paused before a blimp-sized drift, lay on her back, and with her arms and legs sculpted angels out of snow. She barked at the cold, crisp air, just in case the dogs could hear her. They did not answer, so Truth marched farther northward, skipping from floe to floe. In the ever-present dusk, the snow itself seemed to dance and slide, though around her all was still. Truth was nearly home. How did she know when she arrived? There is no pole at the pole. If you were there, you would miss it, would mistake it for just another patch of ice. The earth, after all, is round, and its wastes are unmarked by mapmakers' lines. Yet Truth knew when she was home. She stopped at once. She blew into her hands. Truth sat and clutched her knees. The world spun stubbornly beneath her. She cracked the icicles that hung from her hair. She hugged herself and shivered. A single teardrop swelled from her eye, froze, and bounced down across her reddened cheek. Why the tear? Let me see if I can explain. Are you among those unfortunates who ever mourning the home you left behind feels least at home when you regain it? No? All the better for you. But Truth is, she is perhaps foremost in that tribe. So having climbed the globe to that frigid point where the compass needle, unable to find any further north, spins indifferently, and having craved for countless bitter miles the teeming solitude of wind and frost, truth at last arrived, felt nothing, none of the expected joy of homecoming, just the cold gales blowing through her and nowhere left to go. Truth lay down there, her bum on the motionless pivot of the earth, her hands and feet alike stretched southward. Everything was southward. She sucked in one last lungful of that most perfect and rarefied air, and though only just arrived, shoved off with her feet and sledded headfirst off, shedding here and there a bouncing crystal tear, laughing at herself as she slid all the way down the shimmering surface of the earth. Thank you. So let's start with a question based on the story you just read. So, writing often feels a bit like reaching into that hat and not knowing if you're going to get something bloody or something nice. What is for you the most important thing about writing?
I think the most important for me about writing is being honest or telling the truth. I think that, you know, very often in life you say the things that people want to hear, or you say the things that kind of makes you sound smart, you know. But when you write, for me this is kind of this kind of territory in which you have to be honest, you know. And sometimes you can be honest and it comes out boring, you know, but basically when I write a story and I feel that I'm kind of cheating or trying to impress the reader or whatever, then I stop writing right away. You know, it doesn't make any sense to keep writing like this.
What does it mean to be honest when you're, to be telling the truth when you're, you know, in the realm of fiction? And making up fiction is lies, right?
Well, basically, I think that, you know, that the telling the truth has nothing to do with any kind of facts, kind of. You know, you don't have to kind of say any details that are kind of factually true. It's just kind of being connected, I guess, to what you feel. And I don't know, but when you're dishonest, you feel it. You know, at least I feel it. I'm sure that you do too. But basically, you know, you write kind of in two hats because you write both fiction and non-fiction. So it's a question, it's kind of being true when you write fiction and being true when you write non-fiction. Does that mean something else to you?
Yeah, and they're both, they both have their own challenges. I think in some ways, and this is counterintuitive, telling the truth in non-fiction is sometimes harder than telling the truth in fiction. You know, I think when I approach a story as a journalist, there's already so much that that you are supposed to think about it. There's a pre-established reality. You know, most issues that we kind of have to deal with as journalists, there's like a one-line tag, which is how the world, or at least the country, or at least the people who read newspapers and magazines understand it, which is, you know, how we understand that thing. And you don't begin to start telling a truth about something until you can get beyond that one-line tag and often tell a truth which is completely the opposite of the common understanding about whatever it is. So it actually often means, you know, taking the, you know, whatever research you're doing, whatever reporting you're doing, whatever, you know, interviewing you're doing, sort of allowing all of that to get past whatever you might have thought to begin with, and to get past those easy truths and try to get it at something usually more ambiguous and usually more painful than that simple story. And you know, journalism and, I'm sorry, fiction, I think, you know, because there is no, you don't have the same set of notes in front of you. You don't have your interview notes. You don't have all of that. There's a more, you know, you're only up against yourself and what kind of truth you can tell. And, you know, I think it's like you said, there are sort of alarm bells that start to go off when you know you're not getting it right, and that you're actually lying, although you've been, you know, technically lying the whole time.
No, I guess that with nonfiction, really, there is this thing that many times you can get stuck with the details, like, because many times you can kind of tell, recite all the details or tell all those details, but in the bottom line, what you say with all those details really doesn't mean anything beyond them, you know. I think I tried to work as a journalist, and I was always very bad with it, because basically I would kind of always have get all my facts straight, but I had a feeling that when you read the piece, it didn't really kind of resonate the feelings that I had when I was in this place, you know. It was just a bunch of facts one on top of the other. I find nonfiction writing much more difficult than fiction writing.
I didn't start to feel like I was good at writing nonfiction. I felt like I was good at writing fiction. I didn't feel like I was good at writing nonfiction until I figured out how to get... to say beyond the facts isn't quite right. But I used to actually keep a file when I would do stories of all the things that didn't fit into the stories that I thought were like the most important thing about them. But there was no place for them in a news story. Like these sort of awful moments, you know, where the expression on somebody's face shifted, or somebody was silent when they shouldn't have been silent, or something like that. That actually told far more about the truth of what I was reporting than anything that like my editors would let me, or I thought that my editors would let me get into the story. And then eventually I figured out I could put those moments into the stories. And my editors, the good ones, would let me. And they would actually manage to tell a different kind of truth and a more interesting and more complicated one.
Well, I used to work for Israeli TV shows. It was a little bit like 60 Minutes. And as a director, and my problem was that I would feel great empathy to all the people that I would have to do pieces on. So I would kind of do those pieces, I don't know, about somebody who embezzled out of money or killed somebody. And I always, like, you know, would have those interviews with them, playing with their children, things like that. So at some stage they kind of kicked me out of the show. They said, you know, we should, I don't know, go and work in some NGO, you shouldn't do documentary work.
Well, let me ask you a question. I think in this country too, certainly there, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, a lot of expectations that people come to fiction with and literature with. And certainly early on when you started, you know, first started publishing, you ended up getting a lot of criticism within the context of Israeli literature, which is, you know, mainly this sort of epic nation-building literature, which, you know, is very serious, focuses on the conflict, focuses on the Holocaust, on all of these big things. And you were writing stories which were not about those things, or not, at least when you were writing about them, you wrote about them obliquely. And you've been accused of sort of avoiding that reality. Do you feel a responsibility to that reality, or to any sort of given reality?
Well, again, you know, I feel very much committed to the reality around me, but I really think that you have those kind of, let's say, CNN or newspaper spectrum that take a lot of stuff and put it kind of in the foreground and say, okay, this is what your life is about. But basically, the personal everyday experience is completely different. You know, it's basically when somebody kind of gets up in the morning, you know, he doesn't ask himself as he wakes up, you know, will the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ever end? You know, he just asks himself, you know, why doesn't my girlfriend like me anymore? Or I wish I could buy a car. And then, you know, and let's say kind of, some thoughts, let's say, he could say, I wish I could buy a car, and then he could say, yeah, but I don't have money. And then he could say, yeah, I don't have money because I don't have work. And he could say, I don't have work because I worked in tourism, and since the Intifada, there is no more tourism. And then he could say, I wish the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would end. But this is the order, the way that people think, you know? They don't think those thoughts in the foreground. And whenever I kind of put those things in the foreground, I feel like I'm cheating. It's kind of a little bit like, I don't know, it's like always when you go to a place and you buy postcards of a place, those postcards never feel like the place, you know? You never people who live in a city never buy the postcards of the city because they know that LA it's not a sign of Hollywood. Maybe it's some neighborhood, you know, with helicopters flying over at night. It's much more LA than so. So I really try to avoid this kind of arresting this usual suspect.
Or you can sometimes find postcards of LA which just have pictures of freeways.
And I or traffic jams.
There always seem to be empty freeways in the postcards.
Wishful thinking. But you talked about the writing traditions, and for me, let's say when the of course you know there are many different kind of writing in American tradition. But for me, when I think about American writing, I think a lot about New Yorker stories. You know, it's always something always kind of for me hyper realistic kind of writing. And so, how do you feel, kind of writing here stuff like the stuff you do that you write that I think that let's say in Europe it would be seen as something much more common, but here it would be seen as a little bit shaggy dog tail, that's how you call it.
Literature in the US in the last couple of decades especially has become really extremely convention bound. I think something happened in post-war American fiction. There was a sort of one strand, which is a sort of tradition of sort of modernist experimental things, which had a much more open relationship to experimenting with narrative, which didn't have any real fixations about, you know, reality and capturing it and thinking of literature as a photographic attempt. And another which was much more conservative, and it's that conservative one which I think takes a certain social reality as a given and works within it and takes a certain narrative strategies as sort of the exclusive ways to go about creating a fictional world. And I think what that's meant is that, well, who was the head of the Nobel Committee, chided American literature for being provincial, and a lot of American writers got very upset about that. And I think actually he's right. Our literature is very different from a lot of what you see in Europe, and I think a lot of it has to do with the predominance of this realist tradition, which goes to great efforts to sort of hide the tricks that it's playing. To present this world as given and hide that this is fiction, but of course it's an entirely fictional world with its own tricks, with its own rules, but the things that readers come to expect from literature, which are three-dimensional characters that you can identify with, a plot that moves along in a certain way and eventually reaches a resolution, etc. These are tricks. There's nothing real about them, I think the work that I try to do and the work that I think is most interesting is work that actually sort of poses questions about the realities that it's offering and the realities that the reader is given outside of the work, and tries to make those things complicated.
Well, it's funny because what you're saying kind of reminded me that I gave this workshop in Wesleyan in Connecticut. For writing, and I had wonderful students there, but some of them came from creative writing programs, and it seems as if like they had this attitude towards writing as if it was some sort of an exact science. There would be a story and they say, oh, it has too many adverbs, you know, and stuff like that. And they talked to me a lot about the concept of the well-written story that I was kind of unaware of before being a foreigner, so I can't pronounce TH. How should I know about, real written story? And I try to encourage them to try and write the badly written good story, because what I was trying to say to them, I don't know if I articulated it correctly, but that there's something many times when you want to write something that is well written, basically most of your focus is about, let's say, the technique and the construction of the story, you're kind of missing the point because you're telling a story. It's a little bit, let's say, when you see people in American Idol singing, then they can sing, let's say, a Bob Dylan song, and they sing much better than Bob Dylan. But somehow you enjoy it less because they're very much focused on how they're singing. They want to sing the song beautifully, but they don't necessarily think about the song that they're singing. While Bob Dylan, you know, he can have the voice of a choking crow, okay? But when he sings, he sings, you know, he's focused at what he's singing. So basically, I really think that kind of this idea of well-written story, many times it turns things upside down. It kind of takes something that for me is less important. You know, if somebody comes to you and he tells you something and he stutters and he didn't get his grammar right, but there is a strong story behind it, you know, then sometimes it's better than somebody who's very articulate but in a way sterile.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the words well-written story kind of make my shoulders tense up. Because I think, you know, what gets left out is that a story should push you with some ideas and should take you somewhere where you weren't to begin with. And I think the well-written story ends up leaving you exactly where you were before you started reading it, which is, oh well.
Was it? She told us to ask for questions from the right. I don't want us to be speaking to ourselves for too long.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. I think you should ask us questions now. Tell me that's how it is in the U.S.
Who are some writers that you admire and look up to? Both of you.
Oh, the question was, who are some writers who we admire and look up to?
I've loved your book, you know.
Edgar Carret.
That's for a reason.
There's a lot. And whenever I get asked that question, all of their names flee from my mind. I'll just mention one, a couple. I've been reading a lot of Roberto Bolaño recently because I've been writing about him. And he's a Chilean-born, lived in Mexico and then Spain for most of his life. And this published all of his. He died in 2003. All of his books were have been gradually translated into English and published here. There's been a huge amount of hype around them, and it's entirely deserved. They're pretty great. Just coincidentally, I'll mention another Spanish writer who is not read much here, but was a huge influence on me, Juan Goytisolo, who is really terrific. I'll think of more while Edgar talks.
Well, I think that the writer who influenced me the most was Kafka. I started reading Kafka during my basic training, I was in the IDF in Israel, go for 3 years of compulsive service, and I think this is the best time to start reading Kafka because basically you always have the feeling in the army that everybody is okay with what's going on, and you're the only one who kind of doesn't get it, you know. So when you read Kafka, at least it's kind of like this feeling that you have in an AA meeting. You say, okay, there is another guy who feels the same, you know. And I think that there was something about reading Kafka that made me want to write, and that was really the effect that Kafka has on his readers, because there's something about Kafka that his writing is very moral without him moralizing his reader. He really, there's nothing I feel constructive or pragmatic about his writing, but it's kind of it just disorients you enough so you'll ask yourself questions that you didn't ask before. And that was something that I didn't know that writing could have such an effect on me, and after reading it I said, wow, you know, I would want to be able to write like that.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with Bruno Schultz, who, when I first read him, just completely blew the, a Polish Jewish writer, whose writing is very much about sort of the isolation of the writer and the sort of bleak world which he through writing and through the imagination just turns into this like, you know, wildly populated full world, which is, you know, if you're doing things right, what you can try to do when you're both writing and reading.
I wanted to ask Edgar, so, okay, the moral world of Kafka, and you identified with that and his methods or whatever they were for expressing that. So I want to know, what was your story about the one that you just read us, according to Edgar Caret?
Well, you know, when I write a story, I never think about what's behind it. But I guess that when I go to readings, I have to come up with some answers. So, so I really think it's a story about writing. I write a lot about magicians as a protagonist because I see a lot of similarity between magicians and writers. I think that basically magicians. They're supposedly doing things that other human beings can't do, you know, but they're just con men, you know. They're just cheating their audience because it's only tricks, you know. It looks like something kind of supernatural is happening, but they're basically just tricking their audience. And I think that the moment that something becomes true magic, it's just the moment when you stop being able to understand what you're doing, when you don't understand and you don't have control on what you're doing. This is when true magic is being introduced, and I think the same is true for fiction writing. That, you know, that I think that all the stories that I had planned and when I written them down, they went according to plan. Whenever stories worth publishing, you know, it's only the stories that kind of surprise you that are worth something. And I think that there is something about this story that it's a lot about the fact that really when you write a story and you reach into a subconscious and you put something out, then many times the things that you put out kind of horrify you, and you're almost afraid that people will see that side in you, and you know, and they will resent that. And then sometimes you share with them this kind of horror and they say, oh, it's so fun, it's so original, where do you get your ideas? Kind of give us another one. And there is something about the story. I can just say, like, not that I'm blaming you for anything, but when I read the story and people laugh, every time it surprises me when people, because I don't understand what there is to laugh about the story. I'm saying it's okay that you laugh, it's a good thing, but and it's kind of, and there is something in it, in this kind of reactions that kind of mirrors what happens to the magician, because you know, like I'm saying, like if people would say, hey, what's with the dead baby, like, you know, you should get treatment, you know, then it would seem much more natural than if people would clap in the end, you know.
Talking to the theme of your discussion tonight about reality. I wonder if you, how the fact that at this particular moment in time that we're living in, I don't mean this year or this month, but this period, it seems to me that the life that we all see exist defies reality. It's almost as if on some days we wake up and gravity is gone. And I was wondering whether or not that is, as artists, and this theme, this question you raise, is reality cracked up what it's supposed to be, how does that affect you as artists in terms of your selection of material, whether or not it comes off your consciousness, or whether or not it's just something that you don't think about, and whatever internal result that you feel comes through your work?
I mean, it's been quite a... These last few months have been something. I mean, find myself keeping saying, wow, this would be really funny if it wasn't really happening. And the you know, the unreality of reality is extraordinary. I mean, one example, you know, we all know Joe the plumber now, right? I mean, as soon as McCain gave that speech, the next morning the New York Times ran an article that, you know, not only was he not a plumber, but his name was not Joe. And, you know, but it, everyone still went with it. McCain is still rolling with it. The, you know, he still supposedly means something, is still something real. And the entire sort of discourse around politics, I think, works on that level of extraordinary unreality, that most of what's being said through this campaign is radically disconnected from, you know, most of what people are worrying about. And has that found its way into my work? Not in any direct way. I'm sometimes jealous that I couldn't have thought of some of these things. I mean, I will say, in the last, for the last couple of years, I mean, I never sit down and try to write fiction that's explicitly political. But I find, I think, politics kind of sneaking in more oblique ways, more with more insistence than they used to. I can't just write about love anymore most of the time.
I feel that I write all the time about the things that are happening. Actually, the last story that I wrote was about the stock market. And the truth is that, again, in Israel, there is something that I would say that it's a country that it's difficult to live in, but it's very easy to write about, you know? And so many times things that happen, you know, just in the news, they sound again like, you know, those strange stories. Yeah, it was another talk. I just remember this thing that there was this incident where in a minibus there was a terrorist bomber who activated his bomb, and basically something went wrong with the bomb, so it didn't explode the way it was supposed to, and he was able just to kill one man and one dog, and the man that he killed was the number one trainer of dogs for blind people who would lead them from place to place. And while doing so, the suicide bomber himself, he didn't die, but he became blind. So, and the other piece was about how blind people will now have a problem getting dogs because the guy who died is the only one who can train dogs for the blind. So sometimes you feel like, you know, it's been scripted, you know, and again, and now with the stock market, I really felt that, you know, that there's something kind of amazing for me because, you know, I don't come from an economical background. The fact that they show you a bridge or a car or a company and they say to you, it's worth $10 billion and now it's worth $2 million and now it's worth nothing. And nothing kind of changes in your world, only the numbers that people are saying, you know, so... So there is something about all those things. Let's say there's so many things in reality that actually are deconstructing reality. You know, that it's fascinating to write about them, just to kind of investigate them, to say, okay, if I travel the distance with them, where will it get me to?
One of my favorite stories that you wrote is about dead people hanging out in a bar and talking about how they died. So how did you die? And I've noticed that a lot of times suicide comes up in your stories, and I was wondering if you had any experience with suicide with friends or...
My best friend killed himself during our army service, and I knew a couple of other people who killed themselves. But the thing is, what I can say is that there was something about my friend's suicide that actually kind of made me start writing. I think that before he killed himself, we talked a lot about life and is life worth living or not? You know, he felt that it wasn't worth living. And I think that there was something in writing that for me is kind of like my answer in a way of why I'm living and what I seek in life. You know, so even the story about kind of people who committed suicide, you know, when who discussed their suicides and stuff. For me, it's all in a way like, you know, it's like all my stories are kind of like commercials for life, you know, and I'm saying some of them are kind of offbeat and some of them are too complicated to be understood as such, you know. But in the bottom line, I think if there's one thing in common for all my stories, that there is some sort of a passion to life behind them.
As writers, would you just take a moment to compare objectivity and reality?
Well, I can tell you something that, you know, if you talk about reality, it's being overrated. I think for sure objectivity is being overrated. No, I really think that, you know, that again, when I write, many people talk about realism compared to other way of writing. Well, what I think is that every experience, life experience is inherently subjective. Objectivity, I think, is just the thing that if there are, let's say, 100 people in this room, objectivity or realism is the stuff that all of us agree on. You know, basically, like, you know, let's say I could feel that, I don't know, that I'm floating in air, but I will not, it won't be realistic or okay to speak about that, or it won't be objective, it won't be accepted. So I say, okay, so I'm not floating in air, even though I'm feeling that, you know. So I really feel that there is something in this objectivity or in realism that it's basically a reduction of our experience. It's just the stuff that we can say and you agree with about. And I think that it's more very important and practical in everyday life because we need to have some sort of common ground. But let's say, but when I write a story, you know, if I feel like I'm floating in air, then I'll float in air. That's, you know, why should I compromise for anything less than that?
Yeah, I mean, I can mainly answer that question with regards to journalism. I started writing journalism in what used to be called the alternative press, which didn't put much of a premium on objectivity, and I never really did either. Objectivity always seemed a bit too easy a dodge, and it seemed like a very different thing to me, and still does. Than truth, and you know, truth is a really difficult business, and something you can only, you know, hit from side angles. But I think it rarely has anything to do with objectivity. And I think you can write an extremely something very subjective and something even fictional that'll come a lot closer to truth.
Can you talk about your book for children, and do you think you'll ever write another one?
Well, my book for children, it's called The Dad Runs Away with the Circus. I know that in the U.S. it was banned from Barnes & Noble stores. Like, they were not allowed to show it because they said that the name was offensive towards single mothers. It's funny, you know, for me, like, it's a book that came out in 12 or 13 languages, but my U.S. experience was very kind of enlightening. I kind of discovered things about American society through children's book, because basically in the first spread in the book, there is a father who enters his children's bedroom and wakes them up, because he wants to speak to them about something. And it was a bedroom that were, on one side there was a bed of a girl, and on the other side of the room there was a bed of a boy. And basically this edition again appeared, you know, I don't know, in Chinese, in Korean, in French, in German. But in the U.S. editions, they wanted to have it re-illustrated because they felt that that it's not proper that a girl and a boy will sleep in the same room. And I had kind of an email exchange with them saying that I grew up with my brother and sister in the same room and nothing happened, you know? And it is just that because our parents couldn't afford to have more than one room for us. And I got this email that saying something that they really don't want to judge my parents' priorities. But they think that some people may see it in a different light. And in the end, I didn't want to get it really straight, but the illustrator said, you know, that maybe it's more important, because I always get into those kind of principle arguments that gets me nowhere, you know. But she was kind of more practical than me. So basically, in the American version, they sleep in separate rooms. I love writing for children. It's difficult for me to understand if I'm writing for children or writing for grown-ups. You know, I have to kind of ask other people about it. I think it has a lot to do with my own personal upbringing, because my parents are both Holocaust survivors, and many things about the way that they've raised us were kind of strange, because my mother was orphaned in a very young age, and my father never had a normal childhood. So basically, a lot of the stuff... My mother always said that, you know, that when you raise up your children, if you had a nice childhood, then you imitate what your parents did, and if you had bad ones, then you do the opposite. But she said, you know, I have no reference, so I'm just kind of experimenting here. And one of the things that my parents always did was that during the war, their parents would tell them stories, but they wouldn't tell them stories from books, because they didn't have any books, you know, at certain situations. So they would make up the stories. And my parents were aware of the fact that there are children books in the market, but for them it was like kind of feeding your children McDonald's, you know. It's like kind of, if you're a real serious parent, you kind of make up stories for your children. And my father or my child would make up those amazing stories that would always take place in a bar. They were always about drunks and prostitutes. And you know, and I would ask my father, you know, what a prostitute is, and he'd say that it's a person who makes, whose profession is to listen to other people's troubles. And I would ask him, what's a drunk person? He said, it's a person with this medical condition that the more liquid he drinks, the happier he gets. And by the age of 5, I decided that when I grew up, I'd become a drunk male prostitute. But things didn't work out.
Thank you. This is a question for Edgar. Without making any prejudice for the priorities of your parents and your father, have you ever been requested to change a storyline due to the view that it would be unpolitically correct or wrong in any way in a certain society, relating to the question of the one-bedroom, two-bedroom house?
I've been asked quite a few times, but I must say that as somebody who really agrees to do anything in real life, when it comes to my stories, I'm very, very stubborn. You know, it's basically, you know, when I have to write characters that are very much distanced from me, you know, I always try to find one thing that I have in common with them, and it's kind of a starting point to write the character. And once I wrote a story about a hired killer, and because, you know, being a vegetarian since the age of 5, I don't have that in common with hired killers, you know. The thing that I started writing the character from was the fact that the guy said that he never rejects any contract. Sometimes they hire him to kill children. Sometimes they hire him to kill nice elderly women. He never rejects a contract. And he said that the moment that you reject a contract, then basically nobody deserves to die. So the moment that you allow yourself to kind of, you know, to kind of employ your judgment and saying this guy I'll kill and this guy I won't kill, then you should leave the profession. And I picked this kind of characteristic because it's something that is very true for me, that the moment that you say, okay, you know, this I cannot write because I offend this person, this I cannot write because, you know, I don't know, people won't want to publish it, the moment that you start to make this kind, to think in this kind of way, then you cannot keep writing. That's what writing is all about. It's kind of being able to do what you feel and what you think. And because, you know, all the time, kind of, I'm whizzing my way through life, you know, quite successfully. But when you come to write, you just, you can't do that. There is something like, I don't know, there is a switch that kind of turns you off. You know, the moment that you start kind of thinking like that, then no stories will come out.
You said earlier that sometimes you've written something and you've looked at it later and you were surprised at what had come out of it and that you were maybe afraid of someone seeing that in you. Have either of you ever written anything that has later on completely embarrassed you or that you haven't been happy about?
Probably.
You mean embarrassed in the sense that, I don't know, we looked at it and we thought that it was not good, or embarrassed in the sense that it said something about us that we were, wouldn't have wanted to admit?
I think it's always, not always, but usually a little bit embarrassing putting your work out into the world. Because, I mean, you can't help but, you know, you're in your writing, you're finding things which you didn't even know about were there, you know, and you know, they're not often not very flattering or pretty or anything. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely people I cringe at the thought of them reading my novel or my stories, especially family members. But I can't think of any one thing.
Well, with me, I think that there is something kind of very, very comforting in writing this stuff, even if it is kind of embarrassing, because again, the moment I think that the things that are honest, in the end, they always kind of turn out to be okay. You know, basically, my father talked to me. All my family and friends really like it when I write stories about them. So my father said to me that, you know, that he says, you know, what's strange about your stories is that most of the fathers in the stories, they usually die very violent deaths, and if they stay alive, you know, they're usually extremely stupid and aggressive. And he says, but what's strange about it is that I could see that with all those dead, stupid, aggressive father, that every time I read such a character, I see how much you love him. You know, I see how much you love him. That it's basically, like, I would like to think that I'm not that character, but I would like to think also that you love me as much. You know, and I think that there is something about it that if you, again, you know, that if you write from a place that is not an alienated place, you know, then basically, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like peeing in your pants, you know, kind of, no, really, in the bottom line, you know, it's embarrassing at all, but it isn't that bad, you know, you change your... You change your pants and, you know, and take a shower and it's okay, you go on with your life.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.